Taylor case, the Amanda Taylor case, with Mr. Hamrick and Ms. Kiernan. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Mr. Hamrick, whenever you're ready, sir, would you like to reserve some rebuttal time?
Yes, ma'am. 4 minutes, please.
Very good. Thank you.
May it please the court.
Yes, sir. You may proceed.
Your Honors, my client was convicted of first-degree murder in violation of Virginia Code Section 18.2-32. The issue here on appeal today is whether the trial court erred in refusing to strike one single potential juror. In this case, 23 jurors were called, 6 jurors were struck for cause, and 4 jurors were questioned individually about their knowledge of media coverage as well as outside information regarding the trial. Particularly addressing here on appeal is Juror Knapp. And when looking at the selection of jurors in a criminal case, we are looking at the 8.01-358, which we have a 4-part test here, but really in this case we're focusing on prongs 3 and 4 of that test, and really specifically narrowing to prong 3, which would be, has the juror expressed or formed an opinion? So the question becomes, did the language that Juror Knapp used show that he had not only formed an opinion, which we would submit to the court that he had, but did the juror sufficiently state that he was able to set aside that opinion and hear the case impartially? Of course, as your honors are well aware, and it's well established that the right to an impartial jury is guaranteed under both the Virginia Constitution as well as the United States Constitution.
Well, impartial doesn't mean ignorance, though. I mean, the jurors can have knowledge of the facts surrounding a case from the media or from third-party sources, and as long as they can follow the law and decide the case based on the evidence they hear in the courtroom and the law they hear, you know, from the judge, that's fine. There's plenty of case law that suggests that it's not reversible error to seat a juror who may have preconceived opinions that they can set aside.
No question, Your Honor, and I think the issue is the last statement that Your Honor made. It is whether they can set those opinions aside.
Well, it seems to me in context here, a number of questions were asked by the prosecutor and the judge that where the juror made it clear he could do that, but then defense counsel, is that you or somebody?
Yes, sir.
Okay, you asked the question then. You indicated you came into the courtroom thinking the defendant was more likely than not to be guilty. Is that fair to say? Answer, just based on what you know, things I heard or read. Sitting right here now, do you still feel that way? Probably yes, I would imagine. Now, the context for your question was, you indicated that you came in here in the courtroom thinking that, and he indicated, based on your answer, that probably yes, he still felt that way. But then the question was, the juror says, well, the way you phrased it, you know, I would be leaning more that way. But the court then interrupted and said, but could you still be impartial? And he says, yes, I believe so. So tell us why the court is plainly wrong in concluding that, given the totality of the witnesses' answers to these various questions, that he can't set aside what he's heard.
Sure, and what Vincent v. Commonwealth it indicates that the court is to look at the entire voir dire as opposed to just isolated segments. And so what we have here is questions by the Commonwealth's attorney indicating that he had knowledge of the case, indicating that he was probably leaning more towards guilty, quote, I would imagine. Then when we go down, we do have Juror Knapp saying that he could render a fair and impartial verdict. However, upon questioning by myself as the defense attorney in this case, he indicated, as the court just said, that he still felt that she was more likely than not guilty. The trial judge then chimed in and indicated that he could, yes, I believe so, he could still be impartial. But I would direct the court.
Where in this case, did the juror ever indicate that after expressing his original position that he could not keep an open mind, that he felt so strongly about his initial opinion that he was not willing to consider the evidence before deciding guilt?
Yes, Your Honor, and I don't believe that he ever unequivocally stated that, and it's clear from the record that he did not.
So if we're looking at this through the prism of an abuse of discretion standard of review, how can we say the trial court was wrong in deciding that this was not such a fixed opinion as to disqualify the juror.
And once again, I would direct the court to the conditional language that he uses, where he says, yes, I believe so, where he says probably leaning more towards guilt, and then he indicates, yes, that he... The way that the defense counsel phrased the question was, would you be leaning more towards guilt? So I would direct the courts to Educational Books v. Commonwealth, which indicates that where voir dire examination discloses that the juror is leaning one way or another, it will not act impartially, that the juror must be removed.
But let's compare some of the cases that the Supreme Court has addressed. For instance, Riley versus Commonwealth, one of the most notorious murder cases, at least in my memory, in this commonwealth. And the initial comments by the jurors were quite similar. They said, I really couldn't say my opinion, but right now my opinion is that he is guilty. He wouldn't have gotten to this point through the justice systems if he were not guilty of these crimes. But those initial impressions were addressed in voir dire, and the Supreme Court said that although they candidly conceded that the news story and the grand jury's indictment had led them to think the defendant was guilty, they repeatedly resisted the vigorous efforts of defense counsel to show that they did not understand or accept the presumption of innocence or the rules governing burden of proof. They both declared that they had formed no absolute opinion, and the court was not wrong in not excluding him. And you compare that with, for instance, Green versus Commonwealth, where the court did find reversible error by the trial court. There the juror said he would have to prove himself innocent, that she had the feeling the defendant was guilty, and she'd keep an open mind and wait until that had been proven. These are not those fixed kinds of opinions in Green. They're more, to me, similar to the initial impressions addressed in Spence in Briley.
And what I would say to that, Your Honor, is that the juror never gave a definitive opinion as to whether he could set that opinion aside and to give a fair and impartial verdict. He did say several times he said yes. However, then he backtracks upon defense questioning as to whether he could set that opinion aside.
Where do you find that backtracking?
Sure. Yes, sir. If we look at the joint appendix on page 86, Knapp clearly indicated that he felt he could render a fair and impartial verdict upon questioning by the Commonwealth's attorney. Then if we look at joint appendix page 86 and 87, upon defense counsel's questioning, he indicated that when asked if he was still leaning that way, he said more likely than not, he still felt that the defendant was guilty. So the argument is, given the totality of the circumstances, that
he went on to say that that he'd be impartial, that he would set that aside. He didn't ever, subsequent to those initial comments, change and say, well, yeah, I guess I really do think he's guilty, and I'm convinced of that.
No, he did not. And then I would direct the court just briefly on this point to the judge's answers and the judge's questions. The trial judge said, but you could still be impartial, and the juror answered, yes, I believe so. Once again, we have that conditional language in viewing the totality of the circumstances. What I would submit is that the totality of the circumstances, the entire voir dire, would create a reasonable doubt as to whether the juror could be impartial, and that reasonable doubt should be resolved in favor of the defendant. Thank you.
Are there any other questions? Thank you, counsel. Ms. Kiernan.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. Elizabeth Fitzgerald on behalf of the Commonwealth. Viewing the entirety of Juror Knapp's voir dire, it's clear the judge in this case did not make manifest error amounting to an abuse of discretion when he declined to seat or declined to strike Juror Knapp for cause. I think, as has been discussed here, Juror Knapp did not have a fixed opinion that repels the presumption of innocence and would make him an impartial juror.
Let me ask you about that, because that's one of the things that concerns me about this voir dire. The voir dire uses the phrase fair and impartial, but that's really not the issue. The issue is, are you willing to afford the defendant the presumption that he is innocent. And that discussion never occurs in the course of the voir dire. Doesn't that cause a problem that the jury really doesn't understand the law in this area?
I would point the court to appendix page 60, which is the beginning of the voir dire where juror Knapp is called and added to the panel. The judge says, and do you understand the defendant, Amanda Barbara Nicole Taylor, is presumed to be innocent? Jurors say yes, and the judge confirms everybody. Okay.
Jurors say, I've been in courtrooms when jurors say yes, and usually it's deafening silence.
Sure. And I think it's significant that the judge in this case went back and made sure, you know, everyone has said this, everyone is on board. The judge, again, talks about as you continue through that preliminary voir dire on 61, you know, rather that there's no reason why these people can't give this defendant a fair and impartial trial. In the individual voir dire of juror Knapp that we were talking about in the 80s, 83, 84, and forward from there, juror Knapp is asked repeatedly, do you understand that what you've heard outside the courtroom is not evidence in this case? It would be hearsay. Can you base your verdict on what you've heard in the courtroom? And I think that those instructions and his answers to those instructions do fairly encompass the principle that you're talking about and do show that he did understand what was going on. The trial court in this case also obviously was in the best position to see what kind of juror he was, his sophistication level, his confidence level when he was answering these questions. And of course, to the extent that he made statements that we could read on this cold record as being equivocal, like I believe so or I believe not. I think the Weeks case speaks to we have to put the emphasis in the place, in the proper place on appeal, you know, that we have to believe he said I believe so and not I believe so, you know, to read that kind of language in favor of the trial court, this case viewing the record with the high degree of deference that is accorded to the trial court here.
How do you distinguish, or what criteria do you find that distinguishes a case like Green where the Supreme Court reversed and a case like Briley where the Supreme Court affirmed? Is there any kind of a bright line or anything that we can look to determine whether the juror is qualified to sit or not?
Well, I don't think there is a bright line, but I think it is significant in reviewing cases like Briley and comparing them, for example, to the educational books case that the defendant cited. And in that case, the juror, when she realized what bookstore they were talking about, you know, announced in opening, I believe, actually, that I know that store. I don't like them. I have great prejudice. I can't sit in this case. And when the trial judge tried to rehabilitate her, she still persisted in saying, "Yeah, I guess I could sit. I believe so. I think I would still be prejudiced." And so you have the person still resisting those efforts. And in Briley, as the court mentioned, we were talking. You know, the Supreme Court noted that despite the vigorous kind of cross-examination by counsel, the person stuck to their guns. And at those Briley jurors, again, as the court has mentioned, said things that I think would be even more egregious than what we have here, where the juror is saying that, you know, it's possible that he could be innocent, but it's not likely. It's a strong statement, and we don't have anything that rises to that level here, particularly as the court noted in context of, you know, when you came in this morning, like based on what you saw outside, you know, those aren't questions that go to what the juror's present state of mind is or the prediction of what the juror would do in the future. And again, the trial court is in the best position to make that determination. So to the extent we're looking for a bright line rule in close cases, the deference has got to go to the trial court who was able to see and hear the juror. And I'm not sure I've satisfactorily answered the court's question there.
I'm looking for something that can't be found, an easy way to distinguish various outcomes in cases.
Well, I mean, I think it's significant, too. What we're looking at here is outside information garnered from the news or something like that. In many cases where the Supreme Court or this court overruled a trial court's ruling, most of the cases cited by the defendant, they involved it was related more to the character of the information that the person knew. In the Barker case cited by the defendant, that juror was aware that this defendant had previously been convicted and sentenced to 120 years and that he was, you know, back before the court on a technicality. And, you know, that kind of information, the character of that information was not such that it could be set aside. In the Cox case cited by the defendant, the juror knew a victim, and this wasn't... the victims had bifurcated trials, but it was the same crime, the same defendant, and that kind of knowledge, that kind of intimate knowledge of the facts of the case were so significant that it couldn't be set aside. What we have here is, you know, something that was heard on the news or something overheard in the jail. I mean, I think the character of what is known is significant.
We get cases like Green, where the Supreme Court tells us that any reasonable doubt whatsoever that the juror is not impartial should be resolved in favor of the defendant. And judges and prosecutors shouldn't engage in or can't rehabilitate a witness or a juror by leading questions. So maybe this is a case where we just follow Green and say there was enough of a question here that the juror should have been excluded.
And to be frank with the court, I don't believe Green was cited by either party in this case, and I'm not familiar with the facts. I'd be happy to submit additional briefing on that matter. But again, I would point to Briley, which is a Supreme Court case, and in that case, the court used the language, you know, any substantial doubt as to the impartiality of the juror needs to be resolved in the favor of the accused. And that's the determination the trial court is making. Here on appellate review, we are one step removed from that process. You know, and to the extent that is a, you know, a slightly different standard. We are looking at this from a different lens, not the same initial standard where, you know, where the trial court is there. And again, I would note, to the extent the court finds it's a close case, we have to look at this through, you know, a high level of deference to the juror. We have a juror here viewed in the context of the entirety of his voir dire. He understood the burden of proof. He understood the presumption of innocence. You know, he was practically cutting the court off during the rehabilitations to agree that he knew what he was doing. He knew he could set it aside. And to the extent that he repeated consistently that, you know, his outside knowledge had given him this preconceived notion, you know, that consistency is not a problem. He was asked the same question. He gave the same answer. It's just that preconceived notion is not problematic, and on this record, you can't say that he wasn't able to set aside that and give the defendant a fair trial.
Questions? Thank you, Ms. Kiernan.
Thank you.
Counsel, you have your rebuttal time.
Your Honors, I think that clearly there is no bright-line rule here. However, the juror Knapp did indicate that he had formed an opinion. I think the question then goes to the next prong, is whether he can set aside or lay aside that opinion. Once again, I would submit to the court, based on the totality of the circumstances, that he could not. Clearly, the case law is very specific that deference is given to the trier of the fact, because the trier of the fact is the one that is able to gauge the jurors, to gauge their responses to the particular questions. What we also must balance at this point is the any reasonable doubt should be resolved in favor of the accused. Your Honor, simply as my final point, I would submit to the court that there is reasonable doubt here based on the totality of the circumstances, and I would respectfully ask the court to take those factors into consideration in making a decision. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hamrick. We'll come down and greet counsel.